Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This
is Straight from the Cutter's
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today on episode 358, we bring you the preview of the September 2022 edition of Retinal Physician. Remember that Retinal Physician can be found online for free at retinalphysician.com as well as in print. I'm joined by three of my colleagues to discuss this issue focusing on diabetic retinopathy. We talk about management of diabetic retinopathy, where do anti-VEGF injections fit in. We talk about things that are in the pipeline for the treatment of diabetic retinopathy and how do we incorporate laser into our practices in 2022 in terms of pan-retinal laser photocoagulation. We end with a discussion of relaxing retinectomies. As always, you can find a list of financial disclosures relevant to this episode in the episode description. You can also find a link to go to the American Academy of Ophthalmology website and obtain CME credits for this podcast episode and many other podcast episodes. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is back with a preview of the September 2022 edition of Retinal Physician. Remember, you can find Retinal Physician in print and online for free at retinalphysician.com. This issue focuses mainly on diabetic retinopathy, although we do have one surgical paper we're going to talk about as well. Joining me for this podcast, I'll go in alphabetical order. First, Dr. Nick Farber from Tallahassee, Florida. Nick, welcome.
Thanks, Jake. Glad to be here.
Next, Dr. Akshay Thomas from the redoubtable city of Nashville, Tennessee. Akshay, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Jay.
And last but not least, Dr. Priya Vakaria, who is in the Tampa, Florida area.
It's great to be back, Jay.
So let's talk about these articles. Remember, you can find all these articles fully online on retinalphysician.com. We are going to not belabor it by going through every part of the article, but use them as jumping off points for discussion. So the first article we are going to cover is Novel Therapies for Diabetic Macular Edema Clinical Trial Updates. This is by a team, first author Ibrahim Ahmed with Arshad Khanani as the senior author. And they cover many things we know already. They talk about the first-line treatments for diabetic retinopathy and diabetic macular edema in particular, including anti-VEGF therapy and available steroid options. So they talk about the recent FDA approval of Beovu and Vabysmo for the treatment, and a little bit about the study results that we won't belabor here, and a little bit about some of the real-world findings with Beovu regarding safety. Then they get into things that are in development, such as the PDS, which is currently not approved for DME or DR, but is being evaluated in Pagoda, which is a phase 3 study. And then they talk a little bit about Kodiak Sciences KSI 301, which is also in study with readouts potentially available in 2023, and end with the discussion of Opthea, PCAL and integrin as a pathway. The last things they talk about are drops. Most of the things we talk about are injections, but maybe drops could be something that would be looked at, and also at pathways targeting senescence. So let's start there, Nick. So there's a lot in the pipeline that we could talk about. I'm a firm believer. I'm not opposed to talking about things in the pipeline, but I've said this in the program before. I think until something gets to phase 3, it's a little premature to start talking about it, because we've all seen phase 1 and phase 2 results presented or really talked about, and then, you know, they don't pan out, and then we kind of move on to the next thing. So, port, we've talked about the port delivery system a decent amount on this program. I think people have disparate thoughts about how it'll be implemented or what are kind of the right patients for wet AMD. What about for DME and DR? So does it change in your mind? So let's assume we don't know the results of Pagoda, but let's say Pagoda shows efficacy and FDA extends the indication to DME and or diabetic retinopathy. Do you view any of those patients as candidates? Do you view them as better candidates, worse candidates than wet AMD? How do you kind of factor that in when you look at your algorithm for treating diabetic retinopathy?
I think it's a really interesting treatment modality on the horizon potentially. So a lot of our diabetic macular edema patients are chronic. A lot of them are getting multiple injections over many years. One advantage they would have over wet macular degeneration is most of them are younger. So their conjunctiva, some of those concerns we have about thinning, some of the erosion, hopefully, and the data is going to have to prove this obviously to get approved, but hopefully it's less. And, you know, we're always looking at risks versus benefits. Well, if you have a patient coming in every 4 to 6 weeks for years on end, I definitely think there is a benefit to having a port delivery system, a 6-month refill on these chronic patients. Diabetes is a chronic disease. It's not going anywhere for a lot of our younger patients. You know, it's the number one cause of vision loss in the working age. So if you could have something that didn't require as often office visits, especially for this working age population, I think that would be a big boon. And it all comes down to, what are the risks of surgery? What are the risks of endophthalmitis, retinal detachment, vitreous hemorrhage, all those things that, you know, we worry about with surgery. But certainly for a working class population requiring frequent treatments, I'm excited to see the results of the study.
Akshay, do you agree? Do you have any more, do you have any additional concerns? You're more excited saying, again, like you could maybe treat DR by putting a port, get more durability in these patients who have struggles getting in the office? Are you more concerned because they're younger, so the port has to last for more years? Which way do you swing on that pendulum?
Yeah, I think Nick summarized it nicely. I think I swing more in the conservative side of things. I think obviously we have, you know, again, in our AMD patients, at least we have maybe some, we're starting to see some of the patients that have had ports for 5 years, getting a little sense of what that looks like long-term. I agree with all the benefits Nick said. I'd say I get concerned, obviously, about, you know, what happens if we have a great therapeutic, which is a 6-month injectable, you know, 3 years from now. Would it be worth leaving that port? And does that port stand indefinitely, right? I mean, in that cervical quadrant, what if they get a Regmatogus detachment unrelated to the port? How does that impact my surgery? So I think with the younger patients and just thinking about their horizon for maybe 40 or 50 years, maybe then over maybe 15 or 20, I'd probably still err on the side of caution.
Priya, anything to add on top of that? And
I mean, I agree with everything that Nick and Akshay said. I think the one thing also for diabetic and diabetic macular edema is there's a lot of other pathways that we're looking at now that can't necessarily go into a port. So steroids are obviously a big target, and, you know, Ang2, and there's all these other targets that are out there that currently at least can't be placed into the port. And so then the question you have to ask yourself is, you know, what if you have someone who's suboptimally controlled with just anti-VEGF inhibition? So it'll be interesting. You know, I'm sure that the port will get repurposed for lots of different medications down the road, but at least currently I'm not super enthusiastic about putting a port in a diabetic eye, but I'm interested to see the results when they're released.
I actually feel like I usually err on the side of caution as well, Akshay. And it is a little bit stressful to put something in somebody's eye if they're not going to follow up. And, you know, maybe you're at a higher risk of infection than diabetic patient. But if we think of this analogous to maybe like a tube shunt, it's not that we're doing it outside of any other glaucoma therapies, but maybe in combination with, kind of like you were saying, Priya, and do those stay in there long-term? What if somebody with a tube does get a Regmatogus retinal detachment, and how do we fix those? You know, it's going to evolve over time.
So here's a thought exercise, right? Because everything is a risk benefit seesaw back and forth. So Akshay, if I told you port goes in, permanent port, but you never have to refill it, it's just a one-time thing, you never have to re-inject this patient, and they have a VEGF continuously now, does that tilt it for you enough, or are you still worried about it? Because I know that doesn't exist, but I'm just curious, because this is one of the things we think about, right? Because part of the problem is, if they're not compliant, it's not going to matter. In 6 months, they're going to run out of medication. In a year, based on what we know about DR, they're going to be back with their progress to PDR if they're uncontrolled. But if it was a cure, would we take the risk of a permanent implant? Like Nick brought up the tube shunt analogy. Obviously, you don't want tube shunts just running around amok, like not being monitored. And it's not a cure. A lot of those patients are still on glaucoma drops. But one of the reasons it's done is because there's a risk of permanent blindness. And the other reason it's done is because it does bring things down to a level where patients that may be an indication for a tube. A patient just cannot be compliant or adherent to their drops. What do you think about that? Would it tilt it enough for you? Are you still nervous?
I think it would tilt it for me probably more. So far we've been talking, I think, mostly about a DME indication. I think that it tilted more in for me in the DR indication. You know, if you had continuous VEGF suppression, especially like in a type 1 diabetic where I would just, you know, there's severe NPDR just waiting for them to get, you know, PDR. If you could have continuous VEGF suppression in those patients, that would certainly tilt it in that direction for me. I think one of my issues currently with is just the agent that we have, right? I mean, we all have patients that don't necessarily respond to said agent. If we suddenly get, you know, port delivery with a great agent that all our patients respond really well to, that would also tilt it for me in terms of DME, in the DME landscape. But yeah, in that hypothetical, yeah, sign me up.
What about you, Priya? Are you signing up too? Or are you still?
If there was something that could be
permanent hardware, but it cured it.
Maybe
that's the sound I made too.
I mean, it sounds too good to be true.
Yeah. It's, you know, the buckle of DNA.
Yeah. So there's a buckle doesn't cure everything, but we put buckles on, and this is different though, because the buckle doesn't allow for direct entry into the eye. So, I mean, a tube is kind of the only thing I can think of. I can't think of another equivalent that we have, you know, a retisert, but there's still no direct communication from out to in, assuming you did an Akshay Thomas, you know, level closure around it. I made that sense. I don't know. I won't be on the spot. I mean, for me, I still don't know. I don't know that you'd have to really map that out. You'd be like, area under the curve. How many years did you save them poor vision and complications? Is that worth in 15 years when they get endophthalmitis? Maybe, maybe not. I don't know. Yeah. There's a quality of life component there.
I think the biggest problem that I have with the port is this unknown endophthalmitis risk down the road. And I think that if we didn't have that, I would have much fewer issues putting in a port. But the thought of having a patient come in with endop and then get a PVR-RD and having to put oil in this eye, something, you know, you can just kind of envision the disasters that sometimes we face in a normal eye. And then now you have a port. What if the port falls out somehow? I don't even know what can happen, but I think all those things make me nervous about placing a port. Although I think in the right patient, it's amazing. I mean, patients who have the port are some of the happiest patients we have in clinic. So I don't want to kind of, you know, poo-poo it in total. I think it's a very niche product, and I think it'll continue to be niche even in the DME PDR sector.
I let's take a spin-off question there, right? So one of the things this is talking about, none of these mechanisms are steroid mechanisms, Nick, right? So the question we don't know the answer to, I'm curious what you think. Do you think that we will be treating DME with steroids in 5 or 10 years?
5 yes, 10 no. I think that there's so much coming down the pipeline. Things are continuously getting better. And for the most part, you know, I think steroids are, they're not my first option. They're not my second option, you know, already. And so as we see, you know, all these potentials, even in this, you know, article, there's going to be more weaponry. There's going to be, you know, more things we can use against it that I think are going to continue to push steroids down. You know, when you factor in elevated intraocular pressure and cataract formation, and what if they have a secondary lens or they're afakic? You know, I mean, I think there's continuously, you know, we can use anti-VEGF in all those patients, but we can't use a steroid. And so I think that they will continue to be used in a select few of patients, but maybe in 10 years, I don't see it.
What about you, Akshay? You're going to be saving all your steroid for uveitis patients?
I'm going to say that we're going to continue to use steroids. I think the breadth of coverage with a steroid, I mean, you can have a bi or tri or quad specific molecule. It's still not going to harass me things with a steroid. I think the other thing for us, like I say, a lot of us when treating DME, a lot of us are quicker to pull for steroids perhaps than others, right?
Yeah.
So I think there's plenty of data to support steroids would have a, you know, quicker drying time, if perhaps a longer lasting effect of maybe a larger side effect profile, but we still tend to pull those steroids later. So I think it's probably just going to push steroids further down our kind of a chain of what, when we use them, that I think steroids are going to stay around.
Priya, steroids, you were 10 years out like Nick, you're a tie-breaking vote here.
You know, I think steroids are great in DME. I think there's always going to be a role for some kind of steroid. But I think that, you know, when we get down the road in 10 years, we're going to be doing injections, you know, very infrequently, and patients are, you know, we're going to have some kind of telemedicine robot doing things. I actually don't know what will happen in 10 years, but I think steroids will continue to be a part of our DME.
Yeah,
patients.
It's going to be such a small percentage, but I think that the problem is, there's going to be these really, really tough DME patients who aren't going to respond to anything else that dry with steroids. I think that problem is that a lot of those patients are not going to see better. And that's a lot of what Protocol U and some of these studies showed is the question is, are we actually helping them or not? Maybe by preventing the vision from getting worse by drying them out. But certainly, I don't think you get the same visual quick. To Akshay's comment, that's a constant debate, is drying faster actually helpful or not? We don't know. Let's transition to talking about severe NPDR, because that's one of the things we've been referencing when we talked about our little PDS thought exercise. This was by Marissa Teeger and Carolyn Bommel from from Tufts, and a severe diabetic retinopathy without diabetic macular edema. And a lot of this is going through things we've covered, Panorama and DRSS and how anti-VEGF can influence DRSS and issues with regarding anti-VEGF. Yoshinokawa, they call that as reference, talking about some of the issues, given that it isn't all these patients who progress to complications, and there are costs and there are risks, and we don't know what the timeline is and what's the buy-in given that they have good vision. And then they also talk a little bit about PDR, protocol S data, and about that comparative data and the complications between PRP and anti-VEGF. They do discuss crunch, which is something that's often brought up, especially in our residency. And they talk about patients who don't follow up, who are in an anti-VEGF group, have these really, really tough outcomes versus the PRP group doesn't do well. And they also cover costs. So this is actually an excellent sort of study. Also goes into PPV versus PDR. And I think this is a nice comprehensive overview of kind of where we are now in 2022 with all these options, and how do you use anti-VEGF for these patients with severe NPDR and PDR. I'll show my hands as I keep asking you guys your opinion. I still don't generally treat my severe NPDR patients without DME routinely with anti-VEGF. There certainly is an argument for it based on the data. I guess the reason I don't do it, and it shows my bias, is again, it wasn't 100% of these patients who progressed. And it's curious, we don't know yet, we don't have that data yet, the protocol W or Panorama long-term data to know, did you actually change the disease course 3, 4, 5 years later down the line? And that's really the toughest thing is, what is your endpoint? What are you following? Akshay, when you think about this issue, do you ever initiate therapy in these patients with anti-VEGF without PRP? Has it changed anything in terms of how you follow these patients, for example, based on the protocol W and Panorama data?
Yeah, great question. So I don't treat NPDR without DME with anything other than monitoring observation. The only thing I'd say is I probably do fluorescein a little bit more often on these patients than I might my average diabetic, just because they get a nub of envy, which I just can't appreciate clinically, then I'll go ahead and start treating them. But I don't have a single patient in my practice that I'm treating with anti-VEGF or even early PRP, to be honest, with severe NPDR. I really don't treat.
Nick, are you going to zag or actually zigged?
I've been doing it so far, but no, I'm with it. I don't inject for severe NPDR without DME. I think that, like you were saying, but diabetes is a chronic disease. So having 2-year data is great, but 5 and 10 year data, you know, are we actually altering the course of disease is what's important to me. Because if we are going to inject, they're going to have to follow up. Well, that's the same problem. And so if they're going to follow up, that's great. Then we'll catch it when we're, you know, I'm ready to intervene based on the data we have. We know that, you know, as they reference in the article, 30% within 2 years of severe NPDR will progress to PDR. And that's, you know, when it's time to intervene. And if they're not going to follow up, then they're not going to come back for the injection anyways. And you're going to end up in the same place. And I don't think you've really altered the course. I would love to do that, but it doesn't seem like likely. I would like to see any data on peripheral non-perfusion and how would that affect decision-making. Is there a subset of patients with just mass peripheral non-perfusion that maybe haven't gotten there to PDR yet, but you're much more confident that, you know, those are really the 30% we're seeing. And could you alter their disease, whether it's with anti-VEGF or PRP?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think that, Priya, I guess I'll swing it back to you. And I would assume, again, generationally, and also if you pull most retina specialists, I think most people aren't going here. I guess the more interesting question becomes with PDR. You know, so once someone has PDR, is it always PRP / combo therapy with anti-VEGF? Is it ever a patient where you decide, hey, I don't want to do PRP for X, Y, or Z reason, I'm going to do anti-VEGF alone? What are your thoughts about monotherapy with anti-VEGF once they do get to proliferative stage?
You know, I know that the data shows that monotherapy with anti-VEGF has, you know, good outcomes in terms of decreasing the DRSS score, but I have a hard time doing anti-VEGF monotherapy because of the non-compliance rate. You know, as the authors point out, you know, Yoshi Yanokawa and I think the Wills group showed that there's a significant loss to follow-up rate in those patients who are on anti-VEGF monotherapy have a much higher rate of vision-threatening complications from PDR as compared to PRP. And so I think that's a real world corollary that patients just have a hard time following up. They have life, they have other medical conditions. And so I have a hard time doing monotherapy. I will always PRP my PDR patients, but I've definitely trended towards lighter PRP than I did maybe at the beginning of my training. You know, I tried to do lighter PRP and do a combo more so of PRP and anti-VEGF. But I try to, I really rarely will use anti-VEGF monotherapy. I think I have a handful of patients whose occupations, like I have a pilot, for example, who prefers anti-VEGF monotherapy, but those are the exceptions.
It's interesting what you said about lighter PRP. I think for me, it depends on the degree of non-perfusion now that we have wide field FA and optos. And I think that now all these PDR patients are created equally. Some of them barely have perfusion beyond the arcades. And I think those are the ones who probably merit full PRP. And then there are those who kind of had mid-peripheral to far peripheral non-perfusion. And again, we have no data on this because there's no data saying that targeted PRP based on wide field FA is effective or just as effective as, you know, what we call aura to arcade PRP, but I usually try to be a little more spaced knowing that the anti-VEGF is also going to be on board and maybe you don't have to zap every single vessel out there, especially since we know from some studies that comboing with anti-VEGF reduces some complications. Actually, I'll swing it back to you. You were nodding a little bit when Priya was talking about she was talking about a few patients based on occupation. Similar for you? Are there any specific types of patients that you do think monotherapy is better than PRP for?
Yeah, I mean, I think at least for all of them, I have the discussion. You know, I kind of tell them what to expect. And this is really if you have a patient that is strictly PDR without DME, right? If they have DME, it becomes a little bit of a simpler discussion. And I think I do exactly what Priya said, just a little bit lighter PRP and treat them with anti-VEGF for their DME. But if it's someone that's strictly PDR, I'll usually kind of go over both options and say what I would do if it was my own eyes, which I would ask for PRP personally in both eyes. But I have patients that just say, you know, no, you know, I don't, or they can't tolerate laser. You know, I've had some patients, I don't block in clinic. I know some of our colleagues, you know, block in clinic. I still haven't mustered the courage to do so. And those patients that I can't get to the OR or just can't tolerate laser in clinic, then I'll treat them with anti-VEGF. But it's a very, very small handful of patients.
What about, Nick, the idea? I feel like this idea sort of died out of the vogue in retina meetings. One, because retina meetings didn't happen because of COVID, but also because COVID maybe disinclined people from you don't want to take patients to the OR. But there was kind of this push a couple of years ago about, hey, like, just take these diabetics to the OR, lift the hyaloid, get some laser in. If you can combo with cataract surgery, great, or get their cataract out first and then do them with their pseudofaking, just get it done, put some anti-VEGF on board pre-op and post-op and they do great. What are your thoughts on vitrectomy as a solution for PDR?
So Dr. Reese Landers was a big proponent of this. He was one of my mentors in fellowship and he would talk about it as, you know, diabetes as a surgical disease and that, you know, if you can get to them at that right place, you know, you get effectively the laser in, you're not worried about anesthesia, you're not worried about, you know, any of the discomfort of clinic and scheduling, you have dedicated time for them, and you're getting the hyaloid up. And so you're, you know, removing some scaffolding for all sorts of complications. You know, he also discussed whether or not ILM removal would decrease the risk of DME. And so there, you know, diabetes, certainly we've all, you know, known it as a surgical disease as well. I think it's a great option. It's not my first option. I think we'd have to find those right patients. You know, I think, you know, if you know somebody's not going to tolerate PRP in the clinic, you know, and you've talked about it and not tolerate it at all, then I think the OR is a great place to do it. But it is also when we think about the younger population that we're seeing, these are not the easiest hyaloids to get up, you know, I mean, you know, and then you're talking about, you know, what if you make an iatrogenic tear and then this turns into a different ballgame. So I think, you know, if you're looking at it, maybe if they're over 50, you know, I think there'd be an age stratification where the cataract, like you're saying, would come into play and also the hyaloid status would come into play. And it's certainly an option, but, you know, it has to be kind of weighed against the risks and benefits.
Yeah, I like that. I mean, I think that it comes down to what we were talking about earlier. What's the number needed to treat? And in this case, flip it around. What's the number of patients who have a disastrous complication where you feel comfortable saving the other X patients, right? So if you save 10 patients, is that worth blinding one patient by taking them to the OR when they had good vision going in? Probably not. If you save 100 patients, then it gets, like, this is all a thought exercise, but it's really challenging to be, as some people that say, the executioner if you do have a problem. I find actually when I'm going to do vitrectomy in those scenarios, I find the outcomes are generally better if they already have some PRP on board. I'm not talking about a TRD that's progressing. I'm saying like if you're going in purely to relieve traction, prevent need for repeat injections. We all have these patients. You've lasered them as much as you think you can, and they just have blood that won't go away, allow you to finish PRP. They can't be compliant, or they can't keep coming back. They bleed in between visits, or they just have persistent traction. They keep bleeding every 3 to 4 months. And it's like, well, do I inject them or take them? I feel like those patients can have really good outcomes if you take them, lift the hyaloid, because they tend not to bleed as much. The hyaloid tends to dissect a little better once they've had some laser in. And I also think they don't have the same degree of post-op inflammation, because you're not taking someone with a perfect fresh fundus and putting a ton of laser in. It's really about adding less at that time than more. But I don't know, do you ever kind of take these diabetics for vitrectomy earlier in their course?
I agree with you. If I have the option of having, you know, PRP on board ahead of time, that's great. But I'd say in the situations where you have these patients that have, you know, pretty good PRP and then you're forced to be or, I completely agree. I feel like your planes are far better. There's already some contraction. There's already, those areas are already kind of lifted, you know, rather than these gummy kind of patients we take with no PRP and nothing on board. So yeah, I agree. I say for my type one diabetics, if they have like a large preretinal hemorrhage, which is kind of dissected, you know, off the macula for me, I certainly like to just get those done sooner rather than just kind of suffering with anti-VEGF injections, a little PRP here and there, just get it done. You know, we like to sometimes wait until our hand is forced in the diabetic patients, but in a patient that just had like a fresh, large preretinal hemorrhage that's kind of dissected that plane for you, I think that's one time where I'd intervene kind of sooner rather than later.
Priya, diabetic PPV, always pre-op anti-VEGF for you?
Yeah, I always pre-op anti-VEGF. I know there's this thought of crunch in patients who have a lot of traction, but I don't know if anyone has ever done a case without pre-op anti-VEGF and had a lot of hemorrhage. It's painful. And so yes, every single one of my patients gets preoperative anti-VEGF.
Can I say something? Last time we talked about crunch, we ended up talking about cereal. So we're not going to do that. So Akshay is back and waiting. But my thing would be, I think crunch is a little overrated. I think it's real. So I think that we're residents and fellows, I feel like there was this discussion in the community, like some people poo-pooed crunch and like, oh, it's not a real thing. Well, I think it certainly exists. And we've all seen cases. I think it depends how you define it. Like for me, crunch is rapid regression resulting in enough contracture to get a retinal break, right? So I don't think progression of traction alone is crunch for me. That's not crunch. That's more like a massage. A crunch has got to be a crunch. Like there's got to be like a snap, like when you eat cinnamon toast crunch, right, Ajay? Like you've got to get that snap. Like it hasn't been soaking in the milk for too long. Not to digress, but my point is that it's got to be that sort of situation. And I don't think we get that many patients with PRP and Avastin or whatever anti-VEGF you're using who get that. And I think, again, Priya, it comes down, like you're saying, it's like that risk benefit. It's like, okay, I'm taking the surgery. It would really suck if I get in there and they've crunched and now the macula is off, right? But like, how many other patients are going to get intraoperative bleeding and postoperative bleeding and all of these other things? And I do think maybe it's all juju, but I do think you can risk stratify the patients who do get crunch. The patients who tend to get crunch, A, tend to be more poorly controlled diabetics. B, they tend to not have had any laser or anti-VEGF on board. It's pretty rare that they crunch on the sixth injection, right? So usually it's you go from this huge high VEGF load to a low VEGF load very rapidly. That can happen with PRP or with injections. And I think the C there is, it's patients whose NV is oriented such that it tends to rip off the retina. And I think it's when they get those fronds extending temporally, especially like in the mid periphery. Some diabetics have this phenotype where the fronds of the NV, they're not around the RKs. They actually kind of go out a little bit to the point you're like, maybe I should get sickle cell testing, and sickle cell is negative, but you're still kind of worried about them. Those are the ones that worry me to just throw injections on board and take them in. Those are ones, if I can, I'd rather put some amount of laser in just a little bit at a time and buy some time before doing just an injection and surgery or just an injection. But I don't know, Nick, any other thoughts on crunch?
Yeah, I mean, I think I've seen it from heavy PRP, more of your massage definition, not the make the break. And so I like to use anti-VEGF, especially before a TRD. I wouldn't say I do it 100% before every vitreous hemorrhage patient. Maybe if they're PRP naive, I'm more likely to. But I do think it's real in the sense that, like you're saying, the tractional membranes probably progress because we know that NV is going to regress. I think you can get it with PRP or with anti-VEGF, though I am curious. You said if you know there's non-perfusion, basically arcades out. To me, those patients have so much inflammation with PRP, especially the younger they are, and whether it's in the operating room or in the clinic. And I actually, from a conversation on this podcast, I do a peribulbar block more in the clinic and do a full PRP because I think I was the only dissenting one who split into two sessions between you and Yoshi. And so, but I've been getting it all in one with a peribulbar block in the clinic. But I see that strong inflammatory response in those young diabetics. Are you all staging those? Do I need to backtrack, or are you?
I mean,
getting it all in because you're worried you're not going to see it.
Well, I think what I would tell you, Nick, is if you really think they're not going to come, it becomes that number needed to treat is how many people are going to get worse, right, or how many people you're preventing from blindness. But I usually like to split in half at least. So what I'll usually do is do a slit lamp PRP first and kind of go 360. As far out as I can go. And then that's going to be, so I don't count spots really, but that's going to be what, somewhere between 600 to 800 large spots, 400 micron spots. And then I'll throw in LIO afterward to fill in like in another session. If I'm worried about
what's your power and duration?
Oh, whatever gets the job done. It's high. To get those size spots, you need a much higher power and duration. But I really like those spots, especially if you're using a pattern scanning laser personally. I think that one, you need four times as many spots if you're using a 200 micron spot because it's a diameter, not an area. But two, I just think those spots, the really tiny spots, that was shown actually in protocol S, I believe, is that pattern scanning laser was not as effective as traditional argon. I think one of the reasons is the spot size and the parameters they're using. The duration and stuff is different. But any final thoughts on PRP and laser? From anyone, I know we went long on this one. I think it's an interesting talk though on like laser and how you apply it. Let's talk about
what's your light PRP?
I like PRP.
I just want to know what their light PRP. No, what's their light PRP definition also? Because I'm curious if you guys do the same as Jay.
Is light PRP is that spot number? Is that like area or the parameters for you?
It's area. So I won't bring it as posterior. I'll still treat out to the aura, but I might do mid periphery out. And then if they need additional treatment, I'll bring it more posteriorly. I still say the areas that I fill in are adequately filled in. I just don't bring it as posterior.
So you're telling what the old school grumpy attending is called, boutique PRP, millennial PRP. I've heard both those terms thrown out in our some of our retina meetings.
It's funny.
It's the PRP that expects to be the best, even though it is. No, I'm just kidding. No. So Protocol V is the next article we're going to talk about. Protocol V, we don't have to spend much time on it. It's a very important study, but compared to PRP, in my mind, it's very boring. So Protocol V, this is a great write-up done looking at how does Protocol V influence your treatment results. Just as a refresher, your Protocol V DRCR SNP study randomized patients with 20/25 or better vision in DME to observation, focal laser, or injection. And big takeaways from the study is all the groups did great. It didn't matter what you did. If you watch them, as long as you get treatment, and many of those patients never need treatment, and if you follow them and treat them as needed, then you are fine. So it's interesting. They talk about the difference between clinical significance versus secondary significance. They talk about the percentage of eyes was better at 2 years, was slightly better with Eylea versus laser versus observation. What does it matter? Does it actually matter? I guess my question, we'll ask one question each. Protocol V, Priya, do you think it matters? Like, do you think that was, like, for me, it didn't. I'll tip my hand. I don't think it mattered to me. For me, it proved that you can watch and, you know, you just need to really counsel these patients, make sure they come back and catch up later, quote unquote, if you need to. They don't deteriorate. DME patients rarely blow up in front of your face within a month. I mean, they're slow moving. Do you think those differences in visual acuity outcomes mattered between the groups?
No, not at all. I don't think that matters at all. I think if anything, it just, those small differences make me even more confident that patients who are 20/25 with DME do not need to be necessarily treated. Now, the authors went into these like four different clinical scenarios where they had these patients who had different life circumstances and showed how some of them could benefit from treatment. And I agree that, you know, you take all of these results and you individualize it for the patients and for their clinical situation. But for the most part, no, I don't think any of these patients need to be treated.
Yes or no?
And I think it's important for one reason, which is, I'd say historically, I think a lot of us did what this study did, which is patients that are asymptomatic 20/25 vision with mild edema, we watch them. But I think now it's important to be able to say that this is just not something I'm pulling out of my hat. There's data to support this. And also for referring doctors, right? Because a lot of time they're sent like, oh, my doctor said I've got, you know, swelling in my retina, it was an emergency. And you can kind of explain to them that there is, you know, data to support the approach we're taking. I think it's useful. It hasn't changed what I do, but it's still useful.
Nick, yay or nay? Thumb up or thumb down, Joaquin Phoenix?
Completely agree with Akshay.
That reference might be dated. I'm sorry. There's going to be some fellow out there who does not understand that reference.
What's a gladiator? Yeah.
All right. Let's get into something more interesting. Relaxing retinectomies. We'll end there. Nothing to do with DR, but Grant Justin and Sharon Feckert put together an indication in pearls for management of a relaxing retinectomy. Something that is always discussed at retina meetings, and everyone does it a little bit differently, but there's some big pearls here. I'll say the biggest ones. They talk about you need to peel before you cut. That's a great pearl. Always remember that if you're a fellow listening. Never start. Once you start to cut, you've committed that you're probably not going to peel after that. So peel everything you want. Do you put a buckle? We'll talk about that in a minute. That's a great question because some people say no in retinectomy. Some people say absolutely. Where do you put the retinectomy? I think that was the question I had biggest in my mind as a fellow. It was like, they'd be like, okay, we're going to retinectomy from here to here. And I'd be like, oh, I don't understand how you figured that out. So where do you put the retinectomy? Not just the clock hours involved, but anterior, posterior. And then how do you laser that? Do you do PF photo oil? Do you use PFCL? I think most people say they use PFCL. I think it's easier and simpler, but some people don't, which is difficult. Do you cut little sort of spokes into your retinectomy to make it more stable? And then what do you do in the case of complications, right? They talk about bleeding. My least favorite thing in a retinal case, all my fellows will say, is bleeding. What about post-op hypotony? What about you cut the retinectomy and it just won't flatten, then you just have a ball. Horrible, horrible feeling. Never happens to any of us, I'm sure. So Priya, if you had to say your number one most important retinectomy peel for fellows listening, of any of the ones I just said or anything you want to add, what would you say it is?
I think it's something you didn't mention, and that is when you put PFO in the eye, please be very careful to not get PFO under the retina, because that can make, you know, your case that's already frustrating. I find that the most frustrating portions of retina surgery are when you're almost done and then something happens and you have to redetach the retina or do something, you know, when your cornea is already edematous and you can't see. So I actually think that's my number one pearl, is just be careful of your bubbles. Be careful to make sure all the traction is removed. Otherwise your PFO is going to go into your retinectomy or into whatever areas.
Yeah, three big pearls, like you said, for PFO not going under the retina. Number one, you said the stream, where is it directed when you're doing it? Number two is the bubble can't be so close to your retinectomy edge as you're cutting it, right? So a lot of us now will pre-place a bubble over the macula to prevent that great post-op image that others, Reggie Mooney, other shows, where the whole retina is rotated one way when you cut a 180. So we'll put a marble over the macula. But if you fill out that all the way to the edge of where you're cutting, the turbulence from the cutter will cause the PFO bubble to ripple and little bubbles can break off and go under a big bubble. And I think the third is what you said about traction. How do you identify that? One is sort of experience not putting it in past traction. But if you start to see it turn into an oval, if it becomes egg is bad. If it starts not going in one direction, don't keep injecting thinking it's going to work. It's just going to zip the path of least resistance and go under the retina. Akshay, any other pearls for retinectomies? Anything that weren't mentioned by your mentor, Dr. Feckert or Dr. Vicaria here?
Well, one thing I'd say is that if you're, don't leave your retinectomy edge, and this happens sometimes, and I've seen patients, don't leave your retinectomy edge like at 6 or 7 o'clock, even if that's all you needed to take.
Kind of unless you had to. Your retina,
unless you had to, or if, unless you like had to put a buckle on and all that area is really well supported, take it further. Otherwise, you're just going to land up with a bunch of PVR on that same area and redetach. Another thing I'm going to say, and this is something that's especially important when you don't have a skilled assistant, is make sure you get all that retina anterior to your retinectomy, because if and when they detach again, it's going to be a lot, very, very unpleasant dealing with all that, all these cyclic membranes and stuff that have kind of generated from that anterior retina.
How do you handle that if you have an unskilled assistant, which is what most people have?
So I'll do a chandelier. I may not put my chandelier at 6 o'clock. I may just take a separate chandelier and put it through some of my other ports, so I can depress myself. So that way you can kind of move it and not get a glare, rather than just kind of putting one at 6 o'clock or infranasal like we do for a lot of cases. Yeah, so I'll use a chandelier, low threshold for a chandelier if I don't have a skilled assistant. And it's really important because, like you said, you've got perfluorocarbon in the eye potentially at this point in time. You need just the right spot to depress. It's not someone where you're not a situation where you want someone that is not comfortable depressing for you. So I have a low threshold for a chandelier in those patients.
Nick, anything to add?
These were great tips. Mine is super general, but it's applicable, which is be meticulous. Yes. And so that when it comes to bleeding, when it comes to doing your edge, when it comes to the anterior, retina, if you're meticulous with it, somebody said recently at a conference, and I hate not being able to attribute it, but it's escaping my mind. The efficiency is not doing the maneuver faster. Mm-hmm. Efficiency is doing it right the first time, and then you can be faster in between your movements. And so if you are meticulous the first time and you do it right the first time and you diathermize all of your vessels, you do a nice job cleaning the edges, cleaning that anterior retina, making sure that you have one layer of laser, or in this case, they said three. I'm a continuous right at the edge sort of fan because I think laser spots can create your next break if it's too hot. But that's another point of being meticulous, making sure your laser spots are not too hot. And as Priya said, there's nothing worse than getting that in there and then having to redo it all because it's not flattening and you didn't peel it. Has anybody done retinectomy under air? Dr. Charles, I have not, but I would love to. I'm so worried I'd be too close to the choroid. It would be because there's nothing. But I'm just curious if anybody's done this under air, because then you're supposedly, you can see and make sure that it's flat because you're already under air. And so it's supposed to be beneficial.
I have thoughts about retinectomy under air, but Akshay or Priya, anything you want to add?
I found that sometimes when I go to air, I find some of that anterior retina I didn't get. So that's probably all that I do under air is cleaning up some residual, very, very anterior vitreous, probably because just a larger field of view. And also that retina tends to almost move a little bit more anteriorly and flap up under air. So you can actually get that. But I don't plan to do anything under air.
Yeah, I agree. I don't typically plan to do anything under air. Any vitrectomy I do under air is usually because I was not meticulous the first time around and something pops up.
So this came up this last week. We did a retinectomy case and then there was a nubbin very anteriorly by one of the horns, just north of 9. That we saw under air, and I was like, huh, that thing's there. And it didn't really sit down perfectly. Everything else looked great, but it was a little anterior flap, like you were saying. I was like, okay, I'll go get that. And I was just commenting to the fellow I did, I don't really like the idea of retinectomy under air. It makes me very unhappy. And I started doing it, and I was just unhappy doing it. I was like, you know what, this is not worth it. You know, I like your point, Akshay, and what Priya said too, like anterior flap is not gonna flatten down under air. The whole reason I don't like vitrectomy under air is there's two reasons. Number one, if you're not in the right plane, you're going to tend to shallow your eye more than under fluid. Meaning if you're cutting and you're not right on what you're cutting, you're going to aspirate some air and the eye is going to shallow and you're higher risk of hitting the choroid, which is kind of like the operation, like no. That's when you get dinged and you're out of the game when you hit the choroid in these cases. And I think the second thing is the air is working against you and pushing down the retina. Now, the argument is it will show the areas that aren't going down, but I also think it's working counter to what you want it to do. It's a little bit why people argue pro and con the buckle. They're like, well, the buckle hurts you because it's actually pushing the choroid closer to your cutter rather than away from your cutter. I still like to try to put a buckle on just because I think it helps supports the horns, unless I'm going 360, which is always sadness when you have to do that. But those are great pearls from all of you. I mean, I could give a whole 10-minute Sridhar's way of doing a retinectomy, but I will just summarize in saying meticulous is a great pearl, Nick. And I think just be really methodical. It doesn't matter what your system is, but for me, my system is, I don't think you need to, I diathermize the whole edge of the retinectomy. I always tell my fellows, even if I do that, it's still going to end up bleeding because that retina is abnormally thickened and usually tends to be hypervascular. And I'm okay with that, but I don't stop the moment I see a bleeder because I won't make progress if I keep changing instruments. But I'll usually cut a clock hour or two, kick the pressure up if I need to, and then I'll go back and mark that edge. And then I'll move into the next clock hour or two, and then I'll mark that edge. And I'll do that and make sure the whole edge is free on one side, then do my depressed flap eating with an assistant, then switch hands and go to the other side, do the exact same thing, and just being really, really meticulous with the hemostasis. And my last pearls, and we can argue all we want about this, I don't think they need a ton of laser. I think people over-laser their retinectomy edges in terms of width. I think you just need to paint a row, especially if you're using oil. You can make an argument. I would never do this, but I've thought about it. You could actually make an argument if you're putting oil in that you don't need to laser the edge, that it's probably going to be tamponaded by the oil anyway until you remove it. And I guess if you want to remove the oil later, you have to laser in the clinic. But the point is, the laser is not what's going to make it work. And I think the wider you go, I think always just assume the worst case scenario is it's going to fail. And if it fails, you're going to have to go back and cut more. And it's a lot more annoying to cut when you've lost 3 disc diameters of area now, and now you lose more real estate. Keep it thin with the expectation that in the worst case scenario, you're going to have to cut again and maybe free up that edge. And in the best case scenario, if the oil is coming out later, I actually always tend to add a very light row on my retinectomy cases just to make sure there's no micro breaks, something that wasn't covered, because I kind of paint the edge continuously and I'll add an interrupted row later and remove. And I leave room for that for removal. And tamponade, I almost always, unless there's a really compelling reason like choroidals or something else, I almost always use oil. I know that people will say they use gas and it works great. I don't disagree that it can work. I just think that you're doing the retinectomy. They had such severe PVR that you needed to cut out a substantial portion of retina. That means they are the highest risk patient to get PVR again. Oil will not prevent PVR, but it will attenuate it when it happens and buy you some time if you need to go back in. But I don't know if any of you feel differently about tamponade and or laser for these patients. Head shakes all around for this audio format. That's great.
Yeah. Silicone oil. Also, Dr. Yannick Letterman, so I want to attribute it, said, we are not fast by rushing. We are fast by not wasting
time. Yannick would say that. That's a good Yannickism. I like it.
He also quoted Dr. Landers, just to make all of my quotes come full circle, saying, every time I cut the retina, vision leaks out. So that's how I feel about retinectomy. But when necessary.
But I do think there's a tendency, and it's appropriate. There is a tendency for people to underdo it, either not in terms of avoiding retinectomies unnecessarily, or not making them big enough, like Akshay was saying. And I will say you should almost never leave your edge at 6. The only situation I was saying, unless you can't, is let's say you have a retina, let's say you have a buckle previously placed and everything's lasered on the buckle inferiorly, and you have contracture infranasally or infratemporally, but everything on the other side looks fine and is lasered flat, then you have to make a choice. If it really is nice, do I create the retinectomy edge and then hook it into the old laser and leave it at 6? Or am I going to physically rip the retina off those laser scars to free it and cut it? And I think that's a choice. And part of that is how mobile it is and how much, as you're moving in that area, is it just popping off the scars? It's probably not that healthy. Or is it pretty firmly down? I think you're actually maybe doing yourself a disservice by trying to pull off those scars. If you are going to cut it, I do believe what Dean Elliott says is valid. You should try to get it off those scars if possible, if you can do it carefully. I think a forcep can be helpful to gently lift it. Just be prepared that if you unroof a pretty thick scar, you can get a big choroidal bleed because you're going to unroof the RPE with it. So I know this is not a visual format, and I know I'm describing something that can't be described with my hands, but I do think that is the one scenario where you can leave the edge kind of as a 3-clock-hour wedge, is you kind of hook it into the laser, which is kind of your fresh aura on the other side, because it's posterior to the aura already and looks pretty healthy in that. Now, those can work pretty well. It's just, again, like you said, Akshay, a lot of times that infranasal retina is going to contract later and you're going to be sad about it. And so it's just a question of, do you want to try to save it, put oil in, if it fails, go back and exchange oil? Or do you just want to get it done in one shebang and just commit to a larger retinectomy? Maybe they don't need as many surgeries, but now you have a higher risk of hypotony.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I'd say that we kind of briefly discussed about buckles. And I mean, this is a case where, you know, I completely agree. If they have a buckle or I was placing a buckle and that area was flat, I probably wouldn't lift it up, assuming the rest was supported. And that's usually like, I mean, sometimes we see these in like patients with like primary PVR, or you know, they just had one break, which they got PVR kind of around that break where you lasered, and a situation like that, that would be reasonable.
All right, guys, you guys were very generous with your time. Sorry for running over. We had a lot to talk about. Sorry, Protocol B. I know we shorted you. Protocol B is a great study for all the people involved, but didn't spend as much time on it this episode. Nick, Akshay, Priya, thanks so much for joining.
Thanks, Jay.
Thanks, Jay.
Thanks, Jay.
Thanks to our doctors who joined us for this episode. Thank you, listeners, for what you do on a daily basis, the articles you read and publish, the patients you take care of, and the conversations you inspire here each week. Remember, you can find this episode and all previous 357 episodes, and not including this one, on our website, retinapodcast.com. It's retinapodcast.com. They're there archived and sorted by category. You can also find us on Facebook and on Twitter at Retina Podcast and in your favorite podcast app on your mobile device, Android or Apple phone. Remember, we love feedback, so any positive reviews or you can leave in the Apple or Android store are always well received. And remember, we always love your research and podcast ideas. Please send us feedback either by clicking on the contact us link on our website or emailing us directly at retinapodcast@gmail.com. Thanks again to Drs. Ma, Kai, Venkata, and Chang for their help with this episode and the accompanying social media. This is Jay Schreeder signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.